This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, welcome back to the New Books Network. My name is Adam Bobek, and I'm a PhD candidate in sociocultural anthropology at the University of Leipzig. I am extremely excited today to welcome Dr. Edmund Hayes to the program to discuss Agents of the Hidden Imam, Forging Twelver Shiism, 850 to 950 CE, published in 2022 with Cambridge University Press. Edmund Hayes is a researcher at Radboud University in the Netherlands. He is an historian of social, cultural, and religious history of the medieval Middle East. He studied Shia Islam intensively, including topics such as the agents who mediated for the Shia imams, alms tax collection, and excommunication. Dr. Hayes, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
What inspired you to put this book together?
Well, this book came out of my PhD dissertation at the University of Chicago, which I completed in 2015, and then spent several years really entirely rewriting it. So the story goes back. I mean, there's a long version and a short version. I guess the short version is when I started getting interested in Shiism, and in particular of this period of the 9th, 10th century, I looked around at the secondary scholarship, and I sort of felt I was missing something. I was looking for a more richly contextualized picture of who these people were, where they lived, how they interacted with each other, what the sort of major institutions of their lives were, and I couldn't find that. What I saw was information about their beliefs, about intellectual discourses, about the transmission of knowledge. So there was some... Within that, there was some material that tangentially related to these things that I was interested in, but not really systematically or as the main topic. So that was that. You know, I had been interested in the occultation as a topic of doctrine, a question of doctrine, but then I started asking much more questions about, well, how did the doctrine come to be instantiated in the community?
And maybe now's a great time to give listeners a little bit of background information on Twelver Shiism.
Yeah. So there are several branches of Shia Islam. Twelver Shiism is the one that's currently in the majority in the world today. So it's the majority religion in Iran and Iraq, and perhaps in Lebanon, though a census hasn't been made there since 1932. Shia Islam broadly is an answer to the question, who has authority in Islam after the death of the Prophet Muhammad? And Twelver Shiism answers that question by saying authority is held within a specific lineage of the descendants of the Prophet Muhammad through his daughter Fatima and his cousin Ali ibn Abi Talib. And it's a sequence of these descendants then going up to the 11th Imam, who died in 874, and then the 12th Imam, who is a sort of messianic figure who is said to be in occultation. So he's not visible, but he's somewhere out there guiding the Muslim community. And that's these are the 12 Imams that the name 12 has come from.
And the book begins with the death of the 11th Imam, Imam Hasan al-Askari. And you outline the problems that the Imami community faces at this point. What were they?
So the Imamate of al-Hasan al-Askari had been a stormy, short-lived affair. He was an imam for 6 years. He was quite a young man in his 20s. And he had not been the only candidate for imamate. There were two other candidates for imamate when his father died, or towards the end of his father's life. The first was his elder brother, Abu Ja'far Muhammad, who predeceased his father a couple of years before his father died. The other was Ja'far, who claimed to be the rightful imam and continued to press his case to be the imam throughout al-Hasan's imamate. So this really was a disruptive element. It's difficult to know quite how disruptive. Sources say that the followers of Ja'far, this sort of alternative candidate for the imamate during al-Hasan's life, sources say that they were a real minority. It's difficult entirely to be sure ever with issues like this, because of course you would minimalize the opposition. But certainly it was enough that by the time al-Hasan died, these questions resurfaced and the community was already destabilized by the time al-Hasan died. And then when al-Hasan died, he died apparently with no heir. So there was no visible candidate to succeed him in what had become the most common pattern of succession, father to son. There was his brother, but he had been fighting with his brother. So the people who had supported the incumbency of al-Hasan had a vested interest against Ja'far. They'd sort of founded their interests in opposition to him, and so it was difficult for them to sort of eat their words and say that yes, he was the true successor to al-Hasan. And so you had a situation where the most obvious candidate for the imamate, Ja'far, was not acceptable to, you know, the people who were in power or were at the center of the community. And so that was the real crisis of 874. Who should be the imam?
Right. And now, as you repeatedly call him in the book, and as he's known among Twelver Shia generally, he's known as Ja'far the Liar.
Yes, exactly.
And so what does the community do in this situation?
So I would say some people in the community did continue to believe that Ja'far was a good person, including his descendants. There are the Naqavi Sayyids, who I believe still are relatively prominent in India, for whom Ja'far is a venerated figure. So, but yeah, his nickname in the kind of polemic tradition is Ja'far the Liar, as you say. So a number of things happen within, initially within 24 hours of the death of al-Hasan al-Askari, and then in the first couple of years after the death. Within 24 hours, there's an immediate contestation over two things. One is who does the rituals, the death rituals associated with the dead imam? And the second is who has claim on the property of the imam and the imamate. And I would slightly separate those two things out, what belongs to the imam as a private individual and what belongs to the imamate in the form of, maybe we can call them waqf, you know, endowments or proto-waqf. It's difficult to say exactly what they are. And then the third, I guess, another one is then who is the imam and how do we decide who the imam is? In terms of the property, we have interesting anecdotes that say things like when the news of the 11th imam's death came out, Ja'far the liar went straight to the house and he put seals on all the valuable property and he locked the door. You get a sense that, okay, this is a spiritual position, perhaps a position of religious guidance, but it's also succession to a great family, a rich family, a claim that comes with power and material, material property with it. And that intensifies when the mother of Al-Hasan al-Askari, she also lays claims to the property. And it appears that she might do so because she says there is a child, that her son al-Hasan al-Askari had a child and that she is the guardian of the child. So there's, at any rate, what we can be certain of is there is a property dispute and it lasts for about two to four years and it goes to the courts. The courts of the Abbasid caliphs, who are on paper supposed to be the great enemies, the hated usurpers of the position of the imams, the rightful position of the imams. So again, within the first 24 hours, we see the importance of praying over the corpse, washing the corpse. These are things that are said in the Shia tradition to point to who is the rightful imam. And there are various narratives. It's very difficult, in fact, to piece together what really happened. And a lot of what I'm doing in the book is not necessarily saying here are the facts of the case. In some cases, I do push one answer more than others. But often it's just here are a different set of conflicting narratives, which each come with them a political message about who holds authority. So this person washed the corpse, or this person said a prayer over the corpse. It's putting that person and their affiliates in a position of greater authority. And then also links to this third question of who is the imam. And there are a number of different people. There are these sort of rather stock narratives, stereotypical narratives that we see, where somebody is looking for the imam. They arrive in Samarra, which is where the imam's house was at that time. Samarra was the capital of the caliphate, and the caliphs had demanded that the imams live close to them there. And so we have these Shia believers arriving in Samarra, and sometimes they're carrying money that they want to pay to the imam, or they just want to find out who is the imam. And there are different answers. Some people say Ja'far. Some people say it's the concubine the concubine of Al-Hasan al-Askari is carrying a child. Or we have the development of the idea that there was a child born before the death of Al-Hasan al-Askari. And so, yeah, there are these multiple conflicting narratives about who the imam is and how they prove their authority.
And the dominant Twelver Shi'i tradition today stood by the idea that there was a son born before the death of Imam al-Askari.
Exactly, yeah. We have a few competing accounts about a hidden child. So that idea seems to develop pretty early. But even then, the followers of the idea that there is a hidden child of to Al-Hasan al-Askari have this disagreement between, you know, who the identity of the mother is and whether whether it's born, the child is born before or after. And some of the identity of the mother also brings up the question of freedom or unfreedom. There's one account that it's a free woman and another is a concubine, so a slave woman, which is ultimately the sort of the canonized account. And there are different names associated with these women as well. Some say the mother of the imam is Saqil, some say Narjis.
You mentioned the city of Samarra, and before we get into the discussion of the agents, I thought we could talk a little bit about the cities that play a key role in the imami community at this time, because they also play a very key role in the book that I thought was very exciting. So you talk about Samarra in what is currently Iraq. You talk about Qom, which is in modern-day Iran, excuse me. You talk about Baghdad in modern-day Iraq, and you talk about Kufa in modern-day Iraq. Could you kind of link these four cities together and what roles they played for the community at that time?
Sure. Well, broadly, in the history of early Shiism, you see a shift of where Shiism is from Kufa to Baghdad and Qom. Kufa was the place where Ali ibn Abi Talib, the man who is canonized as the first imam, ran his caliphate. It was the capital of his caliphate. And his also where al-Husayn, his son, who launched an unsuccessful rebellion. He was traveling to Kufa to meet up with his followers there. And many of the early scholars and key figures in the Shia community were based in Kufa. By this time, by the late 9th century, early 10th century, the shift away from Kufa had really been accomplished. At least that's what I see from my sources. When it's surprising, really, even though this shift is visible earlier, but it's surprising how few of the key figures who are really foundational in the idea of this hidden imam being the real imam, the true imam, how few of them are based in Kufa. And what is central in the central axis on which the new 12 community is forged is the relationship between agents of the imam who are based in Iraq, so Samarra, but also Baghdad, which is pretty close to Samarra, and then Qom. And in Qom, Qom is a town that's already by this time famous for the preservation of traditions of the hadith of the imams.
After the death of the 11th imam, we have a part of the community supporting his brother Jafar, and we have part of the community supporting the idea that there was a son born who is the rightful imam, who is now hidden from the community. And these agents develop as representatives of the hidden imam. Who are these agents?
Yeah, well, I should probably now just mention a key bit of terminology in the book, which is the difference between agents and envoys. So I use the word agent to translate the Arabic word wakil, which means somebody who is entrusted with a particular task. And they are men who have been working for the imams for the last several generations. In particular, they've got two major roles. One is being responsible for money that is collected in the name of the imams. So the alms taxes, the zakat, and the khums, which is collected particularly for the imams. Also, probably they might well have some role in distributing it to the needy and the deserving that the imam is giving money to, though we see less of that in the sources. The other main role these agents have is bringing messages to and from the imam. So requests to the imam, requests for information, requests for blessing, and then information coming from the imam. So instructions, messages, orders, prayers, that kind of thing. So those are the agents. The agents are exist both, they exist basically mainly during the lifetimes of the imams. The envoys are agents. They are a subset of agents, but they are the word envoy I use to translate the Arabic word safir, which means someone who travels to and fro, again, doing the business on behalf of someone. It's also the, in modern Arabic, it means ambassador. It's the word that the ambassador in an embassy is used. But it's you know, in terms of meaning, the words agent and envoy are very similar. But in the early Shi'i, early 12th tradition, the word envoy comes to mean something very specific. And that is someone who embodies supreme authority within the Shia community because they are the intermediary of the hidden imam. So the imam is hidden, the imam can't be accessed by everyone, but he is not totally absent. He is still, for a period of time, sending messages to these envoys who then transmit those messages to the community, and likewise people can write questions to the imam. So that is the conception of envoy, and broadly the argument of the book is that the idea of envoy, the office of envoy, does not emerge immediately, right? There is no supreme authority in who's mediating for the hidden imam right from the death of al-Hasan al-Askari, but it, the idea of it, and presumably some kind of office as well, develops gradually. And it develops because in this great moment of crisis, when there's no imam, people, or apparently, people don't know who the imam is, and there are the community are fighting, and there are numerous different ideas about who should be the imam and what imam it means at this moment. At that moment, it's these agents who've been practically embodying imamic authority by bringing letters out, for example, from Samarra to Qum and saying, this is what the imam says, and then likewise bringing things back to the imam. They are a figure of continuity, and that the new creation of a system of authority in the community in the absence of an imam is, you know, really centers on these the idea of this agent who, you know, is at this familiar face for the community. Now, exactly what kind of institutions were practically on the ground at any point in the first decades after the death of al-Hasan al-Askari is very difficult. That clearly there's a lot of back projection going on. There is a canonized vision of these four, a sequence of four envoys from 874 until 940. That does not, that canonized sequence does not emerge immediately. There's a mention of it in Nu'mani's Kitab al-Ghaiba. He mentions them in that's written in 950. But we don't have all the names of them until a later book, Ibn Babawayhi's book, the which is written around 981. So it takes about a century for this idea of these four envoys to really reach something like its canonical form. And there's a lots of steps along the way that are, luckily for us, visible in the what the Twelvers have preserved for one reason and another.
Right, so you mentioned the four envoys at this point. Could you talk about who the four envoys were?
We don't really know who the first two envoys are, actually. There's very little information in them beyond the fact that they are envoys. So there's, as I said, there's a sequence of four men. I would say the first and the last don't really look like they're doing something like the canonical picture would want them to. So really the center of this story is about the second and the third of this canonical sequence. The first two of these men are father and son. The father, Uthman ibn Sa'id al-Amri, and his son, Abu Ja'far al-Amri. Uthman ibn Sa'id, so the father of the two Amris, was clearly an agent during the lifetime of al-Hasan al-Askari. And the canonical narrative that I think are a little later in this kind of early period, this early century when these ideas are developing, the sort of canonical position as it crystallizes is that, yeah, he's the first envoy, and then he gives his envoyship to his son. However, so we have that report in our sources. What we don't have is any record of his activities as envoy. We never see him carrying letters to and from the imams, collecting money explicitly. We do for his son and then for the next man, Ibn Rawh al-Nabakhti. And then again, for the last of these men, who's only in his place for about 2 years, we don't see him really doing anything. And then some people deny his position, and then he dies, and this position of envoyship evaporates, basically. And, well, we can talk about why that happened or not later. But yeah, so these first two, then, we don't really know who they are, other than that they're envoys. They don't really seem to write books. They don't really look like scholars. We don't really have any other biographical information. The sources say of the father of these two Amris that he served the imams. So I don't know if that means he's a servant or if he just served in the sense of he was an agent. They have the nickname Al-Zayyat or As-Samman, which means the butter seller or the oil merchant or something like that. So that could point to the fact they have a professional life outside the service of the imam, or it could be a family name, or it could be a nickname, which we do see. We see in this the secretive environment of the persecuted circles of Shi'ism under the Abbasid Caliph, we do see nicknames quite commonly. Like these are monikers that disguise their real activities. So that's also a possibility. So yeah, we really don't know where these people emerge from, other than they're just doing jobs for the imams. The third of the canonical envoys, however, there's a difference. He is a Nabakhti. Ibn Rawh al-Nabakhti, he's a Nabakhti, which is a family of prominent theologians and scholars. And he's also heavily involved in the Abbasid court. He's a bureaucrat, he's an administrator, he's rich, he's powerful. And he's crucially for historians, he's mentioned in non-Shi'i sources, which just gives us a little handle on the fact that, you know, he exists, he's visible beyond this kind of small secretive world.
So maybe before we move on, could you maybe talk about the canonical picture of the envoys that you mentioned? What are they doing exactly? How are they communicating with the community? How are they using their authority in the community?
Sure. Well, the canonical picture emphasizes the continuity with pre and post occultation. Before, when you have visible imams and the community can ask their questions to, and after, when there's a hidden imam, but still it's trying to project the image that the community still have guidance. There are structures of guidance in the community. That's one aspect. The other aspect is epistemological rather than institutional. And also based on continuity, the idea that, the reason we know there is an imam is because these envoys existed and were in touch with him and provided many reports and letters that showed that the imam was there. So for epistemological purposes, the early 12ers want to prove that there are so many reports about the existence of the hidden imam that it's unreasonable to say that he didn't exist. So that's really the main function of the envoys for the tradition. Historically, what they were doing, as I say, it's harder. And for the epistemological purpose, we just need to know that there were these men. The hidden imam wrote letters very often. That is the key mechanism. They wrote letters. People also wrote letters to the hidden imam. There are, for example, theological and legal questions that the people send to the imam, and the imam then issues a response with the answers to these, showing that he's providing guidance, and not only guidance, but it's of the right quality, the kind of knowledge that they're used to getting from the imam. So that's the traditional view of this man, that they're there on the ground bringing letters to and from the hidden imam.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And so you mentioned the death of the final envoy after just 2 years of being the envoy of the hidden imam. Could you take us back to that?
Sure. Again, we don't know much about this figure other than he's appointed by the previous envoy. There are accounts within the Shia tradition or the broad Shia tradition. So in the book, I not only look at more canonical 12 accounts, I also look at some sort of what I normally consider heterodox Shia texts from the Nusayri community, from a guy called Khasibi, who does accept 12 imams and does accept to some extent the authority of these envoys. So offers a useful alternative view where he is producing knowledge about the occultation, but he doesn't necessarily follow the party line of 12, what is becoming orthodoxy. And he includes an account that, there's a bunch of people who just don't accept the Asamuris, this fourth envoy's position. And clearly, there's a certain anxiety with the very idea of a non-imam standing in for an imam. So under the envoyship of the third of these envoys, Ibn Rawh al-Nabakhti, there's a great crisis where a heterodox figure called Ash-Shalmaghani claims to be, we're not exactly sure what he claims to be. He claims to be somehow a representative of either the imam or the envoy. And he also seems to claim to be something like a prophet or an embodiment of God's guidance himself. This is not only a private scandal in the Imami community, but it's a public scandal, and he's executed by the caliph, by the Abbasid caliph, who gets involved. There are other figures claiming authority, claiming to be Babs. These Bab means gateway, so the gateway to the Imam, who are more or less heterodox, and perhaps because of this, not the envoys themselves, but the very question of the very idea of representing imamic authority is seen to be dangerous. And you see reports that are from the elite, what are called the sort of big men of the community, who just sort of after the death of this fourth envoy, just say no. You know, no, we're not. There are a few people who say, yes, I'm the next one. I'm the next envoy. Or they're questioned, like, are you the next envoy? And, you know, it just seems to be a no. We're not going to have this anymore. So that's, I guess, we don't really know anything about Asamori, really, other than he's designated successor. And then he doesn't have a successor in himself. And what is probably an apocryphal story is that on his deathbed, he has a statement that he issues from the hidden imam saying, after this envoy, there will be no others. And anyone who claims to represent me before the advent of the eschatological end days is a liar.
One thing that you mention in the introduction to the book is really that this narrative that you're telling differs from a lot of other scholarship on the era. Could you maybe touch on what other scholarship on the era is lacking and what you bring new to the table?
Sure. So there are some good studies out there. I'm definitely building on, building on a scholarship. Scholars like Hussein Mudarrisi come to mind, Jassim Hussein, Said Arjomand. What all of these tend to do, with the partial exception of Jassim Hussein, are they're primarily interested in theological questions. And so, you know, even Arjomand, who claims to give a socio-historical approach to the occultation, really is looking at what are the ideas, you know, what are the theologies of rule. So political theology, not really what are the institutions. Right. What is an envoy? What is an agent like? What is their day job like? What are the practical actions and processes that make up life? You know, because I think for me, authority is not just an idea. Of course, idea is an important component of authority, but they are, regular actions, you know, and expectations for action. So one of the expectations of action that is generated by the careers of the final imams is that you have these agents, and that these agents are bringing letters, and so that for many people in the community, the imam is not represented by the body of the imam, a visible person who you can see and say, oh, that's the imam. It's represented by a man who comes with a letter in his hand and reads it out at a mosque, maybe, or in a private meeting. We don't have much information about that. But so I think for me, if you don't look carefully at the details of how authority is structured in practice, then you don't get really at the question of how did the occultation doctrine come to be canonized? How did the 12 community come to be founded? So I'm really trying to sort of put an embodied picture of those processes, an institutional picture of those processes.
One thing that strikes the reader of this book, and I mean, of course, this was a development from your PhD, so it's not surprising, but the amount of research that went into this book is unbelievable. I mean, the sources are so broad and you're picking from all over the place. Could you talk a little bit about the research that went into this?
Sure. Thank you very much. I'm always afraid I haven't done enough. I would say that, I mean, there isn't that much at the core of it in terms of the numbers of books that I'm looking at. There's basically five key sources. What I do and what I'm quite, I guess, proud of is trying to look at all the variegated differences, and not just say, because the typical approach to these very different sources or these very similar accounts, right, with subtle differences, is to sort of ignore the differences and provide a narrative and then footnote the differences, right? Whereas what I wanted to do is read each divergent report as a little mini treatise in itself, right? Each account, each rumor, each story about what happened to the hidden imam or what happened to with these envoys is in itself an argument, or it's a political mini political philosophy of authority. And so taking each of those individually and saying, well, what does this account say in itself? The early books on the occultation are well known, right? There's the well known discography. I didn't discover them. So there's Kulaini's Kafi, which has a lot of account. That's from 940. There's Nu'mani's Kitab al Ghaiba, which actually doesn't have much on the envoys, so I didn't use it that much. There's Ibn Babaway, or Sheikh As-Saduq, is sometimes called Tamam al-Ni'ma, which is from 981. And then there's Tusi's Kitab al-Ghaiba, which is from the mid-11th century. Those are the main sources. Oh, and as I said, Khasibi, this heterodox writer, his Hidayah al-Kubra from, again, the mid-10th century. We don't really know exactly when. Those are the main kind of treatises on the occultation. And then added to that, there's the Shia biographical dictionaries, which were a key source, particularly Keshi's Rijal. So it's not hugely voluminous, but it was a lot of work to go through, try with a tooth comb and say, well, what are all the narratives about the mother of the imam, who she is, right? Is she a concubine? Is she a free woman? What are all the accounts about inheritance? And to go through those, and again, and yeah, so that was the work that this sort of this comes out of.
Maybe now it's also pertinent to kind of ask you what readership you have in mind for a book like this.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'd love to find out, really. I mean, I guess I was broadly writing a book for scholars that I hoped would be usable in a graduate student, certainly maybe even an undergraduate student context for if used carefully. Though it is a bit... I do go into the weeds a bit, so, you know, I'd be interested to hear stories from the front about that, whether it can be used in a classroom. I think there are also, plenty of people in the Shia community who are interested in these questions, critical, no doubt, of my position. But, you know, also some people are very open to discussing these questions. So I have had, little hints that this book's being read in Iran, and people saying, I had someone contact me saying, why didn't you use this book in Persian? A book that I wasn't aware of, you know, which was, it was a shame in a way. But I mean, that also speaks to the cleavages in the field that really, I'm hoping to do better to bridge in the future. So that will be interesting as well, to get some more, to see what kind of feedback I get from, people who are in Iran or Iraq or India. I'm aware of various people. There's a guy on Twitter who was reading my book and commenting and tweeting about it. So that sort of remains to be seen, really, what kind of traction it gets.
Before I let you go, I do want to ask you about kind of maybe a more in the weeds question.
Yeah.
You've mentioned this throughout the interview, and you bring this up in the book multiple times. There's sort of a canonical narrative of the relationship between the Imams and the Abbasids.
Yeah.
And you challenge this really heavily throughout the book.
Oh, good.
Could you maybe go into that a little bit? This is a question purely for me.
That's very interesting that you picked up on that, because I guess that's still, in my mind, that's still on my to-do list. So it's nice to know that it comes out as something that I'm beginning to make inroads in. Well, I mean, it's well known that the opposition between the Imams and the ruling caliphs, who are called also imam, right? A caliph is just an imam by another name. The opposition between those is on paper very bitter, in particular from the Shi'i side. So, for example, there's a famous trope in Shi'i biographies, particularly the later ones, that all imams are poisoned by a caliph or on the instructions of a caliph, which is, almost certainly not true. It might be true of Musa al-Kazim, but then clearly there is a development. It's a development that it's a trope that begins to appear and spread in early Shi'i sources. Clearly, imams and people of prophetic blood claiming religious authority were a threat, to an ideological threat to the caliphs. Whether they were practically a threat depends more on whether they were actually, gathering followers, stirring up discontent, things like that. Family members of the imams did do that, though. So the sons of Musa al-Kazim revolted. By this period, by the late 9th century, the imams have been brought to live in what's sometimes called house arrest in Samarra. So you have both positive and negative comments from the imams in the tradition about this. In one comment, Ali al-Hadi, the 10th imam, says when he's brought to Samarra, it's like, oh, what a lovely place. The climate's great here. I didn't want to come, but now I'm here. It's lovely. So it's difficult to know exactly. I think more work needs to be done in exactly what the relationship between the imams and the Abbasids. But certainly in terms of what's going on in this book, for example, in the inheritance dispute about who should inherit the money of the 11th imam, Ja'far the liar is heavily criticized for resorting to the Abbasids and the Abbasid institutions, the courts, to resolve this case. However, the other disputant, the litigant in this case, the mother, also does the same, right? And living in society, you've got to use the court system. Maybe there was a intra-communal system of arbitration, and you do get little hints at that in the way that the community sometimes write to the imams to say, I'm suffering, I'm in prison, for example, can you help me? But we don't really, there's no very clear smoking gun that the Shia had like a court system with, their own courts to resolve cases. Maybe somewhere like Qom, which at one point and another is like a city-state sort of running itself. The Shia must have used the court system. They somebody like Ibn Rawhah Nabahdi was a you know, he was a literal bureaucrat of the Abbasid court, you know, and used his position to get his rival Shalmaghani executed. So this, yeah, it's and there's a history of Shia bureaucrats that, you know, should be looked into in more detail. So this, you know, the story must be more complicated. It can't be so black and white as Shia sources like to present it. But yeah, I think it's still an open question. So I'm glad you picked up on that. And yeah, I hope I and other people can do more to answer that question.
I absolutely love this book. As someone very interested in this history, it's really compellingly written. Like I mentioned earlier, the breadth of the sources was really fascinating to me. The attention to detail was really fascinating to me. I really, really appreciated the way you told this. There is a final question I have, which is a tradition on the New Books Network, and that is to ask, what are you working on now?
Sure. Well, thank you for the vote of confidence in the book. And I have to say, coming from an anthropologist, that's particularly meaningful to me because, you know, I do want to be, I think it's impossible to do sociology or an anthropology of this period, really, but I've been trying to think more rigorously about sociological questions, anthropological questions. So that, you know, that's meaningful to me that it if it seems successful to you. In terms of what I'm working on now, well, I've got my fingers in a lot of pies. I'm finishing up an empire studies project that was at Leiden University, run by Petra Saperstein, that looks at the institutions of the empire. So we have a book that is in its final stages that we're hoping to publish with Oxford University Press called The Ties That Bind, which is, yeah, about the sort of social connections between people, Muslim and non-Muslim, with government or sort of more peer-to-peer within the Islamic Empire. Since I finished that project, I've moved on to another project at Nijmegen at Radboud University on water and the ideas and the infrastructures for managing water in the medieval Middle East, in cities in particular. And so I'm working on things like how is purity, how is cleanliness conceived, and how does that reflect in the, you know, wells, aqueducts, toilets. So that's really fascinating for me. And that's very different, but it's also sort of broadly connected to my interest in how normative texts, ideas interact with institutions and practice. And then following that, I recently won an ERC grant. So I have, that will give me 5 years of research time to work on a project that's called Embodied Imamate. So very much coming out of this book and looking at, yeah, the material embodied nature of Shi'i community, identity, spirituality, and also, you know, money and things like that in early Shi'ism. So up until the occultation. So that's very exciting.
Wonderful. And I'd love to have you back on the program once these things get out there.
Yes, please.
The book is Agents of the Hidden Imam, published in 2022 with Cambridge University Press. Dr. Edmund Hayes, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you. Great to be here.